This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jake, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Anu Bradford, who is the Henry L. Moses Professor of Law in International Organization at Columbia Law School. She comes to us today with her new book entitled Digital Empires, The Global Battle to Regulate Technology. Anu, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Jake.
It's really great to have you here. I was wondering if you could start off the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I am professor at Columbia Law School. I specialize in European Union law and international trade law, antitrust, and digital regulation. And the last couple of years, I've been working on this book called Digital Empires, which really has been a totally joyful experience. There's so much out there that is interesting and that feels relevant to all of us. It really touches all aspects of our lives and ties really nicely to my longstanding interest in comparative law and international law. So the book is really trying to give a big picture framework on how to think about digital economy in the era of geopolitical competition and how there might be different ways to regulate it if you look at the leading technology and regulatory powers. So this is now what has been most in my mind the last couple of years. And when you type for 2 years, it's really exciting when you then get to participate in conversations like that and talk about it.
In the book, you discuss three different models to regulate technology. Would you mind giving our listeners a quick overview of each of them?
Yeah, so central argument is that there is increasingly a global consensus that technology needs regulation, but there is no consensus on what that regulation ought to look like. So I argue that there are three primary ways to think about digital governance. There is the American market-driven model, the Chinese state-driven model, and a European, what I call a rights-driven model. So if I very quickly walk you through these, the basic assumptions underlying each of the models. So the American market-driven model is really focused on maximizing free speech, free internet, free market, and incentives to innovate. So it reserves a very limited role for the government and in practice hands over the governance of technology to the tech companies themselves. So it is a techno-optimist, techno-libertarian view of the world. The Chinese, on the other hand, China is very focused on making China a technological superpower, but also prepared to deploy state resources to achieve that goal. But the Chinese government is also deploying technology as a tool for censorship and surveillance and propaganda in an effort to entrench the political power of the Communist Party and ensure social stability within the nation. So that is a stark contrast in many ways to the values that liberal democracies are trying to advance through technology. So what about the Europeans? Europeans are often in this public debate described as being forced to choose between the American and Chinese digital worlds, lacking a robust technology industry on their own. But in the book, I argue that the Europeans are not able to, and nor are they forced to, choose between the US and China. Because the American model for the Europeans is simply too permissive, while the Chinese model is understandably too oppressive. So the Europeans have pioneered their own third way forward, which is this rights-driven regulatory model, which rests on this notion of a human-centric digital transformation, where the protection of fundamental rights of individuals and the protection of democratic structures of the society and a pursuit of a more fair economy, where the gains from digital transformation are more equally distributed, and that leads to shifting power away from the large platforms to smaller companies, to individual users, and to the society at large. So those would be the basic contours of the three models that the book focuses on.
I'd like to drill down a bit more on the EU's rights-driven model. We have seen that the EU is very good at promulgating cutting-edge regulatory frameworks, such as the GDPR and the upcoming AI Act. However, some critics have noted that enforcement has been lacking. Is this an unfair criticism?
So it is not unfair. I think that is the one of the biggest limitations or the challenges for the European regulatory model. So you're absolutely right that the legislative track record of the European institutions is impressive. They have promulgated these really ambitious regulations around antitrust and data privacy and content moderation, protection of platform workers. Now the latest piece was the AI Act. So it's really, really impressive. But the enforcement is very hard. And I think there are many reasons for this. So first of all, these tech giants are just massive. They have just tremendous resources, the activity that needs to be supervised. It's very difficult to supervise. It is multifaceted in its nature. Especially then when you are a regulator like the European Union that is committed to free speech, it is harder for you to regulate content moderation compared to a digital authoritarian power like China, where you don't need to manage these very intricate, nuanced balancing exercises of how do you preserve freedom of expression, but at the same time, try to mitigate the amount of disinformation and hate speech online. So partially it is just that when you are committed to rule of law, you are committed to a freedom of expression, free speech, it is just simply harder to draw those lines. And also, if you look at the European Union's efforts to try to deploy antitrust laws, so there's been $10 billion in fines against Google over a decade. And at the same time, hardly anything has happened to reduce the market power that Google has in Europe. And it just shows that in many ways, even the high fines has not been enough to try to entrench this rights-driven regulatory model into concrete market outcomes. Because for many of these tech giants, the fines have just been the price for doing business in Europe. There's still a lot of challenges ahead for the Europeans to show that the rights-driven model works in practice. And I think that's one of the key claims of the book, that it is the challenge for the Europeans to show for themselves and show to the rest of the world that there is a liberal democratic model that is workable and that is capable of also governing the tech companies in practice.
So in your book, you discuss that there are these horizontal versus vertical battles that the three different models have to contend with, both between each others and the tech companies. I was wondering if you could give our readers a brief overview of what you mean by horizontal versus vertical.
Yes, so I think it's helpful for us to think about these two types of battles. So the horizontal battles are something that many of us witness daily when we read in the news about the tech war between the US and China. So that is probably the most prominent horizontal battle that is now unfolding. So it is a battle for technological supremacy, but also for economic, ideological, geopolitical, and I would say even military supremacy. So that is an obviously a costly and highly sort of consequential horizontal battle that really defines the state of the global digital order today. But there's another horizontal battle that is also very important and that we cannot afford to ignore, and that is the battle between the US and the EU. And that is a battle of a different nature. It is primarily a regulatory battle, where the Europeans feel that American tech companies have descended in Europe. They are taking too much and giving too little. They are exploiting the fundamental right to data privacy of the Europeans. They are destabilizing the European democracies by hosting disinformation on their platforms. And they are abusing their market dominance and making the European markets less competitive. So as a response to this, the European regulators have asserted themselves and started reining in these companies, which have then led the Americans to argue that, look, it's not our companies that are overreaching, it's your regulators that are overreaching in trying to rein in our companies and impacting the regulatory choices, not just in Europe, but around the world. So those are, Jake, the two horizontal battles that I focus on. But I also talk about vertical battles, that those are the battles between the governments on one hand and the tech companies on the other. And these are the battles that each digital empire, the US and China and the EU, are now fighting in their domestic markets. And even in the US, even though under the market-driven model, the Americans have been quite reluctant to engage in these vertical battles, there's now increasingly a view that digital economy needs rules and these companies need to be regulated. So the US government is also gearing up for a more intense vertical battle against the tech companies. But what is interesting is that these two levels of battles are highly intertwined. So the US, for instance, remains quite reluctant to engage in this vertical battle, and there's only so far that it's willing to go because these tech companies are its biggest asset in the horizontal battle against China. So the US cannot afford to go very far in restraining the ability of these companies to innovate, else it would have a weaker hand in its competition against China. So that interlinkage introduces elements of restraint to all these battles.
In the book, you argue that the Chinese digital regulatory model is seemingly in favor in a lot of other countries as it exports it around the world. Why is that model winning out over the American market-driven regulatory model?
So in many ways, there has been a backlash to the American model. So these digital giants from the US basically were set free to take over the world. And that is exactly what they have done. And they have brought many benefits to digital societies around the world, but also many harms that are now increasingly attributed to these companies. So there has been a backlash and increasingly a sense that these US companies have now amassed so much power that they can no longer responsibly handle. And that has then led to a set of democratic countries, in particular, to coalesce behind a variation of the European regulatory model. But then, increasingly, in the world that is turning more and more authoritarian, the authoritarian governments and the authoritarian-leaning governments, and many developing countries are adopting a variant of the Chinese regulatory model. And there are a couple of reasons for that. So one important reason is that China is providing them a very critical path to digital development. So the export of the Chinese is this infrastructure power. Chinese companies are building 5G networks and undersea cables and data centers, safe cities, smart cities. And it is it is something for which there is just tremendous demand in these countries. They want digital infrastructure, and China is providing one that is good and that is affordable. So I think that's one reason why China has been so successful in expanding the reach of the Chinese digital empire.
Privacy advocates argue that the United States should mirror the European Union's approach to tech regulation and that right-based framework that we discussed earlier. Critics, however, counter that argument with concerns that regulatory intervention stifles innovation and economic growth. How true is that claim, if at all?
So I am not claiming that all regulation is beneficial. There certainly is type of regulation that can be harmful to innovation. But I don't buy this argument that the European rights-driven regulatory model would necessarily be sort of inverse. But I don't buy this argument that the European rights-driven regulatory model would inherently be contrary to innovation. So it is very easy to observe that the Europeans regulate very prominently, the Americans don't, the tech giants are all emanating from the US, the Europeans have a hard time producing tech companies. So there is this illusion that we would see a negative relationship between stringent, ambitious tech regulation and the rate of innovation. But I think we need to understand that there are many much more fundamental differences in the tech ecosystems in the US and the EU that explain why the Europeans have fallen behind in developing technologies. And it is not because of the GDPR. And it's not that if the Europeans now decided to, after all, just scrap the AI Act and not to regulate AI, that somehow 5 years from now, all these AI companies would emanate from Europe. So in the book, I argue that the Europeans have many other issues that they need to work on. And one of them is that there is no digital single market. It's very hard for tech companies to scale in Europe when they face a fragmented market consisting of different languages and legal frameworks. But they also don't have the similar access to capital as the tech companies have in the US. So there's no deep, robust, integrated capital markets union in the EU. Another issue that I would raise, Jake, is that the US culture and the legal frameworks are much more conducive for risk-taking. So entrepreneurs need to be able to take risks, which means they need to be allowed to sometimes fail. And in Europe, the bankruptcy laws are often punitive. It is very difficult for you to raise money again if you have failed once. And that just means you are less likely to engage in very risky innovations in the first place. And there's also much more of a stigma around failure, whereas in the US, that's kind of built into the venture capital model and the culture of entrepreneurship, meaning, you know, you try very hard things, which means that sometimes you fail, but then your next venture can be successful. So you find people funding that. And I would say that the fourth issue is that the Americans have been so much more successful than Europeans in recruiting the global talent to come to the US and innovate for the benefit of the American digital economy. So if you look at just even the over $1 billion startups in the US, over 50% of those have an immigrant founder. And the Europeans just have not had the benefit of that diversity and being a hub for global talent. So I want to highlight those in the book just to try to sort of shift the conversation away from this, in my view, simplistic notion that somehow digital regulation would always lead to less innovation. I think you can have both. The Americans could emulate a variation of the European rights-driven model, adopt a federal privacy law, regulate AI with a heavier hand in order to protect the rights of individuals. And that would not dismantle the American capital markets or rewrite the bankruptcy laws or prevent the immigrants from coming to the US. So that's one of the central arguments of the book, Jake.
Well, Anu, we're just about out of time. If people want to find out more about you and your work, where should they go?
So they can go to my website. So the book itself has a website, digitalempires.info. They can also find me from my Columbia Law School website simply by searching me with my name. Of course, I would hope that would entice the people to read the book, because obviously we had a great conversation. I really appreciate all the questions, Jake. But I think what the book really tries to do, that it tries to be very nuanced analytically. So if you invest in the time to read the entire book, I think there's much more color that we can still introduce to the conversation that we had today.
I 100% agree. It was a great read. Well, thanks again for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Jake.